B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, January 27th, 2020. Lots of news to report and comment on today. We're going to dive in and do our best. The Trump trial is being upended by revelations attributed to John Bolton and a damaging videotape released by Lev Parnas. We'll get to that in our impeachment coverage coming up in the second half of the podcast. But we know that impeachment is covered elsewhere, and we want to keep up to date on important news in other sectors. And we lead with the latest poll numbers showing that Bernie Sanders has pulled into a clear first place in Iowa. 25% Buttigieg, 18% Joe Biden, 17% Elizabeth Warren, 15%. And Amy Klobuchar, the neighboring Midwestern maven, she's coming in at only 8%. So it is a provable surge for Bernie Sanders. Likewise, in the national polling averages, we see that Sanders has tightened up the lead. Tightened up his second place position to Joe Biden. They're within a nominal margin of error, with Biden leading at 26% and Bernie Sanders now rising to 23%. Warren nationally is at 15%, Buttigieg 8%, and Mike Bloomberg has pulled up to 7%. So the storyline is clear that Bernie Sanders is rising in the polls just in time for the early primaries, which often set the tone for what follows. And the media is scrambling. Here's a headline from the New York Times: Sanders versus Biden, still the soaring storyline. And so even though Biden is not on the rise and is fighting to maintain his position in the early primary states, the media frames it as, it's a two-way race now, and that remains to be seen. So inevitably, when you become the top poppy, as some of my friends from Australia taught me, you're the one that gets cut down. So there are quite a few stories I'm going to cite from recent editions of the New York Times. Here's one that echoes what I reported on Friday, and I do apologize due to technical problems. Friday's podcast wasn't posted until Saturday, when I could come in and fix this glitch in the system that uploads the audio file to our server. At any rate, the Washington Post had reported with alarm on Friday that Bernie Sanders supporters have such dominance on the internet that without any proof, they speculate that it's either Russian bots or it's just like Russian bots. Bernie truly is crushing it on the web with exponentially more activists than the candidates who trail him. So this article doesn't mention the Russian bots, and it doesn't really detail statistically the huge advantage that Sanders has online. But they talk about how, there's a view amplified among Sanders boosting accounts across social media. And the issue here is that they are making the claim that Bernie Sanders is completely responsible for the expressions of his supporters. And I will acknowledge, particularly after Elizabeth Warren stabbed him in the back, that many people didn't take that very well. And they were getting angry and aggressive and using these snake memes to describe her. And I do not support that. I distance myself from that kind of activity. I don't think it's helpful. And I think it just alienates people who Sanders supporters will need later if, in fact, he succeeds in claiming the Democratic nomination. So, for example, they list a bunch of people who now are afraid of the Sanders backers. Some progressive activists who declined to back Sanders have begun traveling with private security after incurring online harassment. Several well-known feminist writers said that they have received death threats. A state party chairwoman changed her phone number. Well, these, you know, are various levels of activity that, you know, certainly is not something that I condone, but it's part of the rough and tumble of a political campaign. Then this sinister paragraph. When Mr. Sanders' supporters swarm someone online, they often find multiple access points to that person's life, compiling what can amount to investigative dossiers. They will attack all public social media accounts, posting personal insults that might flow in by the hundreds. Some of the missives are direct threats of violence. Some. How many? That is left to the reader to imagine. And here comes a fact-free statement. With more than 10 million followers on Twitter, Sanders has a larger audience on the platform than Warren, Buttigieg, Biden, and Amy Klobuchar combined. A sizable number could be automated bots or fictitious accounts. And here's where they enter, the Russians. But that is pure speculation. A sizable number could be automated bots. Now, what I reported from the Washington Post on Friday/Saturday is that the allegation of bots kind of falls apart because it's Facebook, where the Sanders supporters are dominating, and it's Twitter, where the bots have the most impact. So, this is just another effort to paint Bernie Sanders as wild and dangerous. They note that on Reddit, which I don't frequent, that there are 384,000 members in the Sanders for President group, and the group for Joe Biden has 3,100. So what they are reporting between the lines here is that Sanders is very effective at using social media. And any winning Democrat this year has to have those assets because Trump uses social media so damned effectively. That's the best way I can put it. All right. Here is the second piece that demonizes both Warren and Sanders. The dateline is Pittsburgh, and they cite the Democratic mayor, Bill Peduto, and the Democratic lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, who are both all in on fracking. Fetterman quoted, "In Pennsylvania, you're talking hundreds of thousands of jobs that would be unemployed overnight if the pledges to ban all fracking were actually put into effect." And Mayor Peduto said the Warren Sanders ban all fracking right now position would absolutely devastate communities throughout the Rust Belt and pit environmentalists against workers at a time when Democrats need both. And so these are the calculations that come from moderate Democrats. That we can't stand on principle. We can't address the greatest threat to life on Earth. We have to really accept the threat of job loss and its impact on voters in Pennsylvania as a reason to change those policies. And I believe that it's this kind of, micro-targeting, the efforts to move to the center, to preserve corporate influence in the party, that these are miscalculations. Because it is a time for bold leadership. That's what will turn out voters across the country. That's what will counter Trump to the greatest degree. And so I consider this to be a political screed. Then on Sunday, in the opinion section, the Times trots out Ezra Klein, who says, "Democrats can't win running the kinds of campaigns and deploying the kinds of tactics that succeed for Republicans. They can move to the left, and they are, but they can't abandon the center or, given the geography of American politics, the center-right, and still hold power. Winning the Democratic primary means winning liberal whites in New Hampshire and traditionalist blacks in South Carolina, talking to Irish Catholics in Boston and atheists in San Francisco, inspiring liberals without arousing the fears of moderates." Well, this is bullshit. Because if you do gain momentum with the half of Democrats who describe themselves as liberal or very liberal, the rest will surely follow. Now, certainly some will hold their noses if they vote for Sanders. Others may actually vote for Trump. But I believe the only path forward to energize younger voters and get them to turn out in high numbers in particular is to take strong stands. And here is the one piece that I saw in the New York Times in the last 4 days that actually is pro-Bernie. It's an opinion column by Elizabeth Brunick. Headline, Bernie will have to fight dirty. Sanders' recent struggles indicate his greatest handicap may be his unwillingness to wage total war. And she cites the case of Bernie's apology for the essay written by Zephyr Teachout. And by the way, on Bill Maher's show on Friday night, he referred to some of the important elements of Zephyr Teachout's essay, her op-ed. But he was flatly wrong by describing her as a top official in the Sanders campaign. And similarly, what's his name, McCall? Michael McCall, the former Obama ambassador to Moscow and a big promoter of the Russiagate scandal, a toady of Hillary Clinton's and clearly a Sanders opponent. He made some false comments about it as well. So I've linked to this article by Ms. Brunig, and I recommend that you read it, because she goes into detail and says that Teachout's essay is sober and specific. Putting aside his warm relations with donors in the credit card industry, Biden's record is mottled with more episodes of apparent corruption than Teachout listed in her op-ed. Back in 2008, Tom Brokaw interrogated Biden about the fact that Hunter was employed by the big credit card bank, MBNA. And then she reports that in 2007, Hunter was ensconced on K Street in a lobby shop, a firm grossing $1.76 million in revenue that was based, most likely, on the parentage of Hunter Biden. And so she goes into more detail about his appointment to the Amtrak board and others. But she then says that Sanders can't afford mildness or a steady habit of capitulation. And Bernie brags about how he's never run a negative ad and he doesn't like to go negative. She says Sanders seems reluctant to mount attacks that could be construed as personal. And this reflects that he is a visionary and he is principled. But in this world, systematic forces operate through human hands, and Sanders must fight real flesh-and-blood opponents, too. It will take that much and more to win. And speaking of Biden and his corruption, one of the points that the Sanders campaign has drawn as a huge contrast is that Sanders will support and expand Social Security, and Biden has repeatedly tried to cut Social Security benefits. He's now been lying about that, and I credit Lee Fung and Ryan Grimm at The Intercept with a detailed rebuttal of the recent claims that Joe Biden never said all that stuff and that he's just devoted his entire life to public service and the well-being of working families in the middle class. And the writers do a good job of pointing to Bruce Reed, who is a longtime advisor to Biden and was active the staff director of the Bowles-Simpson Commission that issued a report recommending reducing Social Security benefits and raising the retirement age to age 69. It's a worthy read, and I have several more for you to consider, too, because at the Gray Zone today, they've got two really important analytical pieces, one by Kevin Gostola, who's the managing editor of his own blog and website, Shadowproof, and he's a contributor to the Gray Zone in this piece. The headline, To Rig Primary Against Bernie, DNC's Tom Perez Nominates Regime Change Agents, Israel Lobbyists, and Wall Street Consultants. And as you know, Gostola is a very talented and dogged reporter, and I encourage you to read this piece. Let me just take a couple of quick bites here. Dennis McDonough was nominated to chair the platform committee, Obama's chief of staff during the second term, and he is at the Markle Foundation and a chair of the Rework America Task Force. And acting on behalf of the CIA, he joined the effort to suppress the torture report from Senator Feinstein's Intelligence Committee. Then Gostola moves on to Jake Sullivan, nominated as vice chair of the platform committee, national security advisor to Joe Biden, deputy chief of staff to Secretary of State Clinton, senior policy advisor to her 2016 campaign. Then Bakari Sellers, Dan Shapiro, Wendy Sherman, and Megan Stabler, nominated to the platform committee. Each has been defined as a pro-Israel Democrat, and he goes into detail there. So it is really troubling when you look at the lineup of party insiders, of hawks, of pro-corporate, pro-Wall Street hangovers. They're not hangovers, they're hangers-on from the Clinton campaign and the Obama administration. And it just shows the uphill struggle Sanders faces should he secure the nomination or even get to the convention and be able to run a contested convention. And the other piece of gray zone is the byline of Alex Rubenstein and Max Blumenthal. And they take a hard look at Warren, Elizabeth Warren's newly assembled team of international advisors. And they start with Sasha Baker, who made the announcement of 34 friends, colleagues, and advisors. And she herself was Deputy Chief of Staff for Obama's Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter. There are a bunch of people from the Center for American Progress, people with connections to the National Endowment for Democracy, and 9 have spent time at the Pentagon, 13 at the State Department. So Elizabeth Warren doesn't have a lot of bold new ideas on foreign policy, and I encourage you to follow the link in the show file to check out that report. Last week, I reported that in order to distract from the impeachment trial, Trump invited his fellow corrupt world leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, to come for a visit and to bring along his campaign opponent, the guy who has given him a run for the money twice in the past two elections in 9 months, and the third is scheduled for early March. Now, as I've told you, Benny Gantz is a retired general. He heads the Blue and White Party, and he's only a little better than Netanyahu in there is no hint of corruption. But he's a hardline Zionist. He kisses Trump's ass. He makes, positive sounds about the so-called Jared Kushner peace plan that they hope to jam down the throats of the Palestinians. But Benny Gantz wriggled out of the proposed three-way meeting where he, Trump, and Netanyahu would be photo-op together. And instead, he scored his own separate meeting with Trump today. And while that helps him, I think, in the election, it also means that he could fly back to Israel tonight in order to be there Tuesday to corral the debate over denying immunity from prosecution in the corruption cases against Benjamin Netanyahu. Our own Supreme Court has done it again. They have intervened before cases have run the gamut and really qualified for consideration by the top court. And in this case, it's Trump's policy to deny permanent residency to immigrants who are believed to be likely to use public benefits like food stamps, housing vouchers, and Medicaid. Now, I recognize that we have a long history of requiring immigrants who want citizenship to be sponsored by somebody so that they don't become wards of the state. But this is a cruel class-backed barrier that is being created just to deny more people access to the United States or to citizenship here. And Neil Gorsuch wrote the opinion, actually a concurrence. Today, the court grants a stay, allowing the government to pursue for now its policy everywhere except Illinois, where a separate injunction has been issued. Sarah Pierce, a pro-immigration activist, said the policy will not only unilaterally change the face of immigration, but chill millions of immigrants and their U.S. national family members from applying for or staying in and enrolled in public benefits programs. Just another rollback here in the good old U.S. of A. In Baghdad over the weekend, the protests subsided after Muqtada al-Sadr decided he wasn't going to continue to show up. And the New York Times increased its estimates of Friday's protests up to about 250,000. They had previously reported it was tens of thousands. Well, I've seen reliable reports from media offshore that the number was well into the millions. And antagonism toward the United States is evidenced again in two rocket fire assaults on the Green Zone Embassy The latest hit, four rockets were launched on Sunday evening. The Iraqi government said they didn't do it. They're promising an investigation. And they're, of course, worried about being further squeezed by the United States. We've reported those threats. And a footnote, Trump lied about the impact of the Iranian counterassault on U.S. bases in Iraq. 34 Americans were injured with traumatic brain injuries, which Trump has described as headaches. Two good reports on Julian Assange over at Consortium News today. Caitlin Johnstone reporting something I didn't know. I did see reports that Assange had been taken out of solitary confinement at the Max prison in Britain called Belmarsh. But what Johnstone, the Australian-based brilliant writer and analyst, reports is that Assange was rescued from the cruelty of this globe-sprawling empire by the concerted protests of his fellow inmates. Authorities at Belmarsh have moved Julian Assange from solitary confinement, relocated him to an area with other inmates. The decision to relocate Assange is a massive victory for prisoners at Belmarsh. A group of inmates have petitioned the governor of the prison on three occasions, insisting that the treatment of Assange was unjust and unfair. But you can't hear a single American official, even the alleged progressives in the Democratic Party, utter a word even in that direction. And in a separate report, Nozomi Hayase gives us the proposed schedule here. Starting February 25th, there'll be 1 or 2 weeks of hearings on Assange's extradition, and then it will resume on May 18th for 3 more weeks. And this is a very dicey situation where you cannot expect Britain to uphold basic standards of human rights and international justice. Over at whowhatwhy.org today, a fresh podcast that I recently recorded is up for your consideration. And we talk with David Daley, the journalist and author who is focused on covering gerrymandering, and he details the Hoefler files. Thomas Hoefler was a GOP consultant who masterminded many of the redistricting schemes of the Republicans since 2010. And the files that were released by his estranged daughter after his death show the level of detailed data used to map exact locations of voters and to use race, which is illegal, to draw district lines. That's available for you today at whowhatwhy.org. And at peterbcollins.com, we're posting a recent podcast that was at Who What Why, my conversation with San Francisco's Financial Justice Project director, Anne Stuhldreher. And this is something that makes me feel really good about San Francisco, because after what happened in Ferguson, we discovered that the budget of the town was largely funded on the backs of fines and fees and prison time imposed on the impoverished residents. Well, San Francisco has taken the lead in reducing or eliminating monetary penalties that have trapped so many people in a cycle of poverty. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Anne Stuhldreher.
And again, this is a good example of where in government we're being like a penny wise and a pound foolish. Sure, we bring in a little bit of revenue from these, but then when you look at it closely, again, at the bigger picture, it really doesn't make sense. So in San Francisco, the typical jail stay is 70 days. If someone was making a 15-minute call in the morning and evening, which I understand is fairly typical, it was about $300 over 70 days. And as you mentioned, our analysis showed that it was primarily people's families and support networks who pay for these calls. And so, you know, in San Francisco, when we were looking at this, we heard from so many women who were struggling between paying their PG&E bill and paying for these phone calls.
That's Anne Stuhldreher of San Francisco's Financial Justice Project, and that podcast will be posted at peterbcollins.com either later today or tomorrow. Everybody knows by now that Kobe Bryant, the basketball star of the Lakers, died in a helicopter crash outside Los Angeles in a foggy situation yesterday. And I'm not a big sports fan, and I've never idolized Kobe Bryant. And I'm aware of the 2003 episode where he was accused of rape. The witness didn't testify, but he later basically confessed to it and apologized to the victim. Now, a political reporter at the Washington Post, whose name is Felicia Sanmez, was put on leave today after posting a link to an article about the 2003 rape allegation against Kobe Bryant. And the paper suspended her, saying she had poor judgment. Now, you can argue that the timing may be a little bit off, but I have watched TV. The Grammys last night was full of, grief and honor for Kobe Bryant. But we have to tell the truth about people who die, even if they are heroes to many. And I offer shameful criticism of the Washington Post for its actions. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Jerry in Southeast Portland, Siri, the talented artist in far north California, and I am pleased to see a renewal from our friend Jens Ivan Nielsen on the Danish island of Bornholm. Haven't heard from you in a while, Jens, so drop me some of that free verse in English, will you? I always enjoy it. If you're not a subscriber, you can change that. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, click on become a subscriber, and you'll be there in a flash. Well, over the weekend, as I mentioned at the top, the Trump trial has had some surprises, starting with an audio recording and actually a partial video. It was recorded on the smartphone of Igor Fruman, who was the partner of Lev Parnas. Igor is going the silent route, but Lev, of course, is singing in public. And Lev is no angel. This same tape shows him angling to get Trump support for his efforts to get natural gas deals in Ukraine. And also, Parnas wanted to get into the marijuana business and wanted Trump to fix the banking regulation problems. So, as I say, he is no saint, but he is willing to tell the truth here in ways that really leave the Trump impeachment team trying to keep up and trying to modify the lies that they are telling to the Senate in the trial today.
If you take a look, the biggest problem there, I think where we need to start is we got to get rid of the ambassador. She's still left over from the Clinton administration.
Were the ambassador, were Ukraine?
Yeah, and she's basically walking around telling everybody, wait, he's going to get impeached. Just wait. I mean,
really?
It's incredible. It's
like, she'll be gone tomorrow.
What's your name?
I don't remember his name.
So one of the things that will be, now that we have a Secretary of State,
get rid of her.
Hooray.
It's one of the first things. Get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
Excellent.
Do it.
Make a note.
Excellent.
Yep. Congratulations on Michael Bay. He's doing great.
Yes, Michael Bay. Great one.
So this was at a dinner held at the Trump International Hotel down the street from the White House in a private room. It occurred in 2018 in the spring, a full year before Trump actually ordered Yovanovitch, the ambassador who neither Lev Parnas could name and Trump had no idea who she was. He agreed to fire her just based on the argument from Lev Parnas that she was talking trash about Trump in Ukraine. Now, Parnas has apologized for that and said it wasn't true, but he told Trump that, and Trump acted like he was going to take immediate action. When you look at the details of who else was there, it's really a disgusting episode. In addition to Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who pledged $1 million but only paid $350,000 into the dark money super PAC that supports Trump, along with them there at the dinner was a real estate developer from New York whose company's project in South Korea was proposed to Trump as a possible site for his summit that was upcoming with Kim Jong-un, a Canadian steel magnate who pushed the president to further limit steel imports to the U.S. and whose companies donated almost $2 million to the super PAC, Other attendees discussed government policies that could benefit their businesses, including building a highway for self-driving trucks and regulations. I mean, this is the so-called swamp that Trump pledged to drain. And the accounts also note separately, not at this dinner, but Trump lobbied Prime Minister Abe of Japan to support a casino plan of his biggest donor, Sheldon Adelson. So, Lev Parnas's recordings implicate him, clearly, and he's hoping that, knowing how guilty he is, that fingering Trump will save his own ass. And then there is the John Bolton story, all right? Now, I want to freely acknowledge that the accounts you're about to hear are based on reports that are based on comments that people who have read the book made to reporters for the New York Times. But the byline goes to Maggie Haberman and Michael S. Schmidt, and they have not seen the book. They are simply reporting on accounts of other people. This is hearsay, pure and simple. And it is treated as fact, as the Times and the Post ping-pong back and forth with these disclosures. So putting that aside, it is extremely damaging because Bolton undercut a key element of the impeachment defense that was presented by the president's lawyers in the truncated, the two-hour Saturday session. Over dozens of pages, Bolton describes how the Ukraine affair unfolded over several months until he left the White House in September of 19. He described not only the president's private disparagement of Ukraine, but new details about senior cabinet officials, including Mike Pompeo, and conversations that he had with the Secretary of State. Pompeo acknowledged that there was no basis to claims by Giuliani that the Ukrainian ambassador of the United States was corrupt, and believed that Giuliani may have been acting on behalf of other clients. Bolton said after the July 25th phone call with the president of Ukraine, he raised with Attorney General Barr his concerns about Giuliani and told Barr that the president had mentioned him on the call. Barr denied that he learned about the call from Bolton. The Justice Department said he learned about it only in mid-August. So we've got liars exposing lies by other players in the administration. And all of this will buttress the calls for witnesses at the impeachment. But are Republicans listening? Do they have plugs in their ears? Do they only hear the false arguments presented by the president's lawyers? That's what it seems like to me. And will this actually produce the four Republican votes needed, presumably by the end of this week, to allow selected witnesses and documents to be entered into trial testimony? Well, it is trending in that direction, but it is not ensured. We've got Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, who have publicly said they would support a vote for witnesses. Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who's retiring and taking those plaid lumberjack shirts back to Tennessee with him, he's under a lot of pressure. But so far, he does not seem moved. So we're in a really dicey situation, but it is unpredictable, and it could actually move into the Democrats' position. So just to catch up from my last podcast, on Friday night, Adam Schiff starred in the final session of the Democratic manager's impeachment opening arguments. And I would give him credit for a dramatic but not overplayed presentation. He did a good job, I think, of describing the case that they have, the evidence that has been presented so far that supports it, and the clear obstruction that the president and his allies have engaged in so that they can say, you don't have enough evidence to convict, without saying, because we're withholding the witnesses and evidence that would likely convict Donald J. Trump. And then these clowns, Jay Sekulow, Pat Cipollone, I guess, And they've got another guy named Purpura, Deputy White House Counsel. They trotted out all the president's talking points. That's what they did on Saturday. The Democrats are trying to overturn the 2016 election. They tried with Russiagate. Now they're trying with this. And there's some truth to that. But mostly they bluster. They talk about process. And they try to divert attention from the actual evidence that has been presented by the Democrats. So they cherry-pick the video collection from the House impeachment inquiry sessions. They basically, you know, find a clip here or there that supports their point of view. But it's a pretty weak soup that they are serving up. And while I don't think that Adam Schiff is 100% credible, he does have a strong case that he's presented. And the vulnerabilities that he has is that on Saturday, the Republican lawyers waved around the Mueller report because Schiff has tried to meld in some of the Russiagate narrative and arguments into the Ukraine trial here. I also feel the Democrats are quite vulnerable because they protect and defend the Bidens 100%. They don't acknowledge even the appearance of impropriety and the sorry track record of Hunter Biden benefiting from his daddy's fame and his stature. Also, the flat denial of Ukraine involvement in 2016. We've previously cited Yasha Levine's arguments that, yes, the black ledger that implicated Paul Manafort and other activities that were going on in Ukraine do indicate, at least to some extent, that there was an effort. And also, while in Friday night's closer, Adam Schiff tried to pre-butt claims that he had lied by misleading presentation of Trump's phone call with Zelensky. He did call it a parody before and after he made that presentation. But, of course, it's selectively edited to make him look like a liar. And whether you want to side with Schiff or not, it is a vulnerability that they face. So looking at some notes here from the Saturday trial, Cipollone began with the time-honored trick of the trade. He flipped the script. They, he said, are here to perpetuate the most massive interference in an election in American history. And this is the kind of projection that Trump uses. I think on Saturday they felt that only he was watching, and that's who they were trying to convince. And Schiff had made a comment Friday night that's worth quoting. For a man who loves to mock others, Trump does not like to be mocked. So by promoting some clearly false statements like this, White House lawyers attacked the House impeachment by saying it was made up of selective leaks and staged public hearings of hand-selected witnesses, and the president's legal team was shut out. No, they were not. And Cipollone falsely asked, if you were really confident in your position on the facts, why would you lock everybody out of it from the president's side? Well, the president was offered the opportunity to make arguments or to come to the inquiry hearings himself, and he did not. So as I mentioned, only Susan Collins and Mitt Romney of Utah have publicly said they would support a vote for new witnesses. That requires two more Republicans to find a spine, and we can't be sure that that will happen. Mike Pompeo got himself into a dust-up with NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly. And I don't listen to NPR very much because I don't find it compelling. They play it safe so much of the time. They are so in fear of Trump and conservatives cutting their federal funding that I find it a kind of bland presentation. But I give Mary Louise Kelly credit for the hardest-hitting interview I've heard on NPR in ages. And she took on Pompeo, and I heard the part where he was dodging her questions about Ukraine and whether he had supported properly his ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch. And as Pompeo grew more angry, he cut the interview short. He falsely said that the interview wasn't supposed to be about Ukraine. And then, reports Kelly, I was taken to the secretary's private living room, where he was waiting and where he shouted at me for about the same amount of time as the interview itself had lasted. He wasn't happy to have been questioned about Ukraine. He asked, do you think Americans care about Ukraine? He used the F word in that sentence and many others. He asked if I could find Ukraine on a map. This is so degrading. So she said yes. And suddenly his aides could produce a map of the world with no text on it. And she successfully identified Ukraine, and then he put it away, and he said, people will hear about this, and he dismissed her from the room. And the emails have been released by NPR showing that she did, in fact, indicate that she was going to talk about Ukraine. When a flack for Pompeo tried to say, let's just keep it to Iran, she said, I plan to start with Tehran, but also Ukraine, and who knows what the news gods will serve up overnight. I never agree to take anything off the table. So we have Pompeo joining Trump, sputtering about fake news and the media in this country. And as you know, I have many criticisms of the media, just like I said about NPR. But this was a moment when NPR did something it can be proud of, and it's Mike Pompeo who is the asshole. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.